welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about the ransomware cyber attacks, the WannaCry situation hitting computers around the world. Also, a little bit more about white supremacist rallies happening in Virginia and some of the foreign policy issues emanating from the White House. But before we can move on. Many people thought that when the Stock Act was enacted in 2012, it would put an end to insider trading in Congress. Well, they thought wrong. Recent reporting by Politico has shown that while perhaps the process has certainly become less of a factor, there are still quite a number of trades going on by members of Congress that at the very least represent conflict of interest issues and at the most may indeed indicate trading on illegal information. It also once again put the spotlight on political intelligence firms and their role in furnishing insider tips to Wall Street from Washington insiders. The Politico investigation, not surprisingly, found that a fair number of people in Congress are involved in trading on the stock market. 3 in 10 members of Congress, to be exact, 31% of Republicans and 28% of Democrats, 39% of senators and 28% of House of Representative members. However, the reporting also found that the majority of Wall Street trading comes from a relatively small number of congressional officials. The top 12 traders are responsible for 2/3 of the trades, and the top 11 of those 12 traders are in the House. On taking a closer examination, Politico found that a good number of these active traders did not have a blind trust. That is, they almost certainly are fully aware of the conflict of interest issues at stake. Here are some of the highlights of the more notable things they found. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Rhode Island Democrat, bought shares in the pharmaceutical firms McKesson, Gilead, and Abbott Labs 10 days before the 21st Century Cures Act, which promised a huge boon to pharmaceutical companies, was made public. Whitehouse and his wife bought additional stock in Gilead and Amgen on November 28th, 2 days before the House voted on the bill. And the day that President Barack Obama signed the bill into law, Whitehouse started a series of 3 sales of shares in those companies. In other words, he loaded up on the stock as it looked like the bill it would pass, then unloaded it when the value was set to rise after the bill passed. Illinois Republican Adam Kinzinger bought a $20,000 stake in a company called Prescient Edge that subsequently gained contracts at the Defense Department. Interestingly enough, Kinzinger's position on the House Foreign Affairs Committee allows him to weigh in on some of the issues on which Prescient is working and at least theoretically use his perch to assist in their ability to gain more contracts. Representative Chuck Fleischman, a Republican from the state of Tennessee, bought into 2 different companies developing cancer drugs in the summer of 2016 when Vice President Joe Biden was promoting the cancer moonshot idea. One of the investments came just a week before new measures to speed up approvals for cancer therapies was announced. Mike Conway from Texas, also a Republican, introduced a bill that would allow nuclear waste to be stored in this district. Wow. The following spring, the company that would operate that facility applied for a license at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and literally days after that, an account controlled by Conway's wife bought stock in a nuclear power company that stood to benefit from the storage facility. There's also Democratic Representative Kurt Schrader of Oregon, who sits on the House Energy and Commerce Committee and has made a number of trades regarding oil and gas companies, which he oversees on that committee. Of course, when questioned on any of this, the Congress people say they have no idea what was going on and that, in fact, their brokers made the trades without informing them at all. However, Politico points out that this makes zero sense, given that many people in Congress have set up blind trust or invest in mutual funds, something that's very easy to do, to avoid these exact kinds of conflicts. The fact that many of those making active trades do not, more or less, suggest they know quite well they can influence the outcome of their trades based on insider knowledge. And what about a crackdown by regulators? Well, the one time the SEC has tried to prosecute somebody under the Stock Act, the House Legal Counsel refused to cooperate and used Congress's speech and debate clause, which is supposed to protect lawmakers' statements on the floor, to shield them from any scrutiny, more or less suggesting that Congress made rules about trading but was never intending that they actually be able to be enforced. which is a good place to note another loophole in the Stock Act. Originally, the legislation had a clause that would require political intelligence firms to register like lobbyists. Now, these firms specialize in gaining information from Washington insiders and then funneling it to Wall Street for handsome sums to guide their investments. It essentially is an insider trading machine that operates in the shadows and gray areas. Given that the Stock Act doesn't clearly define what exactly are prohibited in terms of what you can receive and as it concerns the tips you give these firms, it also offers another way for those in Congress to broadly influence their portfolios by helping Wall Street in general get ahead of the curve. That includes staffers too. For instance, if you manage a fund for a senator and you hear from a political intelligence firm that something you've invested in for that senator is going to gain a lot or take a hit from legislation, what would you do? You'd invest or divest accordingly. Now, this helps all your other clients too, which makes the political intelligence very valuable and makes it very valuable to those firms to make it worth the while of insiders to tip them off. Clearly, a nexus of corruption between Wall Street and Washington, as if there wasn't enough to point to that conclusion already. Either way, now we know the Stock Act did not stop abuses by Congress of the information they have for their own financial gain. And speaking of Wall Street, or really corporate America more broadly, Reuters reported this morning that they will not let this tax holiday thing go. That's corporations, that is. Major multinational companies are pushing the Trump White House aggressively to make sure that whatever they do regarding taxes, that they let the corporate America, that they let corporate America bring back profits about $2.6 trillion worth that they are holding overseas to avoid taxes. They, of course, claim it'll be a big boon to the U.S. as they drive the profits back into investments that will help lift the economy. Now, we've reported on this many times, that this is one of the biggest canards out there, and it really is a backdoor way for these companies to enrich their own investors. During the Bush administration, they did one of these tax holidays, and in the bill, it even included a provision that the money must be used to invest in jobs, not stock buybacks and the like. However, when the new law went in, the businesses mainly used their cash to buy back stocks and pay out dividends. In a 2011 study, a Senate committee concluded the Bush repatriation tax holiday cost the Treasury at least $3 billion in net revenue over 10 years and, quote, produced no appreciable increase in U.S. jobs or domestic investment, end quote. And on that note, in late 2016, the CEO of Cisco Systems, at the time, Chuck Robbins asked what he would do with this money if they could bring it back at an ultra-low tax rate, maybe even 5%. He said, quote, we do have various scenarios in terms of what we do, but you can assume we'll focus on the obvious ones, buybacks, dividends, and M&A, that's mergers and acquisition, activities, end quote. And what about Apple, whose CEO Tim Cook says he wants to use some of these profits as a basis for a big infrastructure deal in America? Right now, Apple claims at current tax rates they'd owe about $60 billion on the money they have stashed overseas. Trump is saying the rate on repatriated profits could be, say, 10%. That would mean Apple would save $40 to $50 billion. Now, what we also know is Apple is one of the most aggressive share buyback companies out there, and this is because Apple's sky-high growth rates are probably a thing of the past, and even though they are still immensely profitable, this won't be able to satisfy investors who want their returns to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. So you buy back stocks in order to deliver the returns investors want and thus continue to attract investment capital. So when I took a look at the latter half of last year at Apple's fourth quarter financial report, it noticed that they had increased the ceiling on share repurchases to $175 billion from the previous $140 billion, and of that, that there was $42 billion that had not been repurchased as of the fourth quarter. So in other words, there's almost an exact match in terms of what they may save in taxes from repatriated profits abroad and how much stock they buy back from investors. Tax holidays are still a terrible idea and clearly an end run around paying taxes that won't help anyone but the super wealthy. You know, there's a lot to be discussed regarding the massive ransomware attack that struck almost the entire world over the past few days. But right now, it seems one crucial thing has to be said. WikiLeaks was entirely correct to raise the issue of the security of cyber weapons around the Vault 7 leaks that they put out. WikiLeaks stated that they were releasing information on these CIA-created cyber weapons to spark dialogue about the process for creating and using them. They noted that they had gotten access to the documents, but that literally thousands of people may also have gotten access because of the massive security contractor apparatus in which it was circulating. Now, cyber weapons stolen from the NSA have been used to hack almost the entire world. This again raises the issue of whether or not the CIA, NSA, FBI should be required in an ironclad way to reveal to companies the flaws they find in their software, or whether they should keep it for themselves. Clearly, this massive ransomware attack is a signal that the risk of leaving open various exploits for the intelligence community only makes the entire world incredibly vulnerable to attacks. It's also clear that the financial value of these cyber weapons is huge, and that anyone coming in contact with them has at least some reason to sell them on the open market. Clearly, there is an important conversation to be had here, but unfortunately, very few people in positions to actually do something seem to want to heed the call from WikiLeaks. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined to continue our conversation by David Swanson, who's an author, activist, and journalist, and also a radio host, and Bob Schlehuber, who's a Sputnik News analyst. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, David, I will start with events over the weekend in my hometown and your current residence, Charlottesville, Virginia. A number of individuals gathered there, I believe it was Saturday night, maybe Friday night, for some sort of torch-lit rally in defense of the Robert E. Lee statue. Well-known white supremacist Richard Spencer was there, was followed the night after, last night, I believe, by another large rally of Charlottesville residents in defiance of this hate. I mean, talk a little bit more about what's going on with this Robert E. Lee statue situation that now it seems to have started to bring in all these national personalities.
Well, you know, there's a very, very bizarre situation in U.S. public understanding now, where things like defense of the Confederacy and outright racism and sexism and exploitative capitalism and tough love economics and cruelty and all things right wing are paired up with being friendly with Russia and where feminism and inclusiveness and tolerance and progressive policies are tied together with hostility toward Russia. And, you know, this is something that partisanship and television news can do, and it's done it very clearly to my mind, so that it's, you know, throughout the understanding of most Americans, but it's rarely written down or talked about. And so you had these people gathered at the Robert E. Lee statue, and, you know, I've written at length at the need to understand where they're coming from and their legitimate grievances and so forth, but they're chanting fascist-sounding things, you know, blood and soil, and you will not replace us, you know, meaning you won't replace our statue of our pro-slavery general, and they're chanting, Russia is our friend. You know, and everybody who finds that confusing and surprising, it just delights me. I'm thrilled by their inability to understand that. But I think it reflects something that's been put pretty deeply into U.S. consciousness in the past 6 months.
Yeah, no, I think that's 100% true. And it was certainly one of the memes coming out of that by a lot of the sort of Russiagate excitable journalists coming in. Bob Schlehuber, your thoughts on seeing this event take place? I mean, I think a lot of people also sort of just the torch lit nature of it had a sort of Nazi-esque rally feel to it among many.
Yeah, or even the KKK kind of feel to it. I thought one interesting comment somebody had was none of them are wearing masks in a time where you have a president that's vocally speaking out and at least not ever qualming anybody's kind of white nationalist, hyper-nationalist sentiments. Now is the time that people are going to come out, they're going to be seen, they're going to be shown, and there's no embarrassment or kind of pushback on a lot of these people for them to speak out. And I guess I'm always kind of curious, too, when we see incidences like this, is this particularly home for the South of America to have this type of kind of racist, outlandish actions by these protesters, or I don't know what you want to call them, white nationalists, and seeing that, if this is something we're going to see in the North now kind of spread, and there's going to be more activities like this around the way, I'm not sure what to make of this. I don't know, Eugene, do you think this is kind of an isolated incident, but after New Orleans, when they removed some of their statues, that we're going to start seeing more pushback, or ultimately, is this a win for people on the left that maybe the statue eventually does go?
Well, I don't think it's a new issue. I mean, I was in the Stonewall Jackson Council of the Boy Scouts in Charlottesville, Virginia. I mean, certainly the Lost Cause mythology, it's probably stronger in Virginia than South Carolina, although they could probably compete with each other for who cares more. I think it was a big step, and we talked about this on the show, David and I, before. I think it was a big step for the city to put this in, that they were going to remove the statue. There's some other state-level laws, so I don't know if it goes down. I think ultimately, though, it's just like the issues being rubbed raw, finally being brought to the surface, where in the past people were a little more afraid in the state of Virginia to challenge the Lost Cause mythology. Now you have a lot of people who I think are much more willing to do it, which I think, David, is the relevant piece maybe of this whole thing, is that everybody covered Richard Spencer being there with a bunch of tiki torches. There was not even close to as much coverage of a very large number of residents of Charlottesville that came out to oppose hate and so on and so forth. And it just speaks so much to me, to the media atmosphere of the country, the things they'll hype up. They're like, oh, Richard Spencer, Russia, let's cover this. But not like, hey, the next night people came out in huge numbers to oppose it.
I had no idea until you just mentioned it this second. I'm in Russia at the time, if that's any excuse. I'm not following the news in Charlottesville closely. But, yeah, I had no idea there was another event the next night. I think that, this process of getting rid of this statue has been an exemplary democratic process that has been open and respective of numerous viewpoints, including some I find incredibly offensive, and gone through deliberations and sought fairness for all parties and arrived at a decision that represented a view and yet compromised it for the sake of others. And yet there's this delay because in Virginia there's a law that says you can't take down any statue. Now, the people who want this statue taken down want it taken down for being racist. They don't have any distaste for war any more than any other Americans. I'm sure they would be delighted at some non-racist war statue. But because of that law, the white supremacists here get this delay in which to hold further rallies in defense of General Lee, and we get war put into the story whether the media likes it or not. And the fact that we don't have a law in Virginia that forbids the taking down of peace monuments ought to become part of that story. And the fact that there aren't any peace monuments to be taken down or left up ought to become part of the story.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah. Bob, so you have about a minute, so we go to break.
Surprised you didn't hear about that. The story in Russia there with Putin calling Richard Spencer to activate and push for these protests, obviously not a story there where Vladimir Putin's not paying attention. This is not Russia's grand strategy, is to fight for the Confederacy to promote their own values here in this own country. But I'll be interested. We often see these movements when people on the right or some of these people speak out and seem like they're almost getting stronger, which this actually feels like. Oh, Richard Spencer's got all these people with tiki torches. This might also be their last gasp as well. You know, sometimes these opposition forces will show their strongest right before they flame out. So I'll be curious if Richard Spencer's tiki torches stay lit much longer. Flame out, you like that one. Or if eventually
that.
These local municipalities are going to be able to start pushing more and more to get rid of some of these statues, and you are going to see more of a progressive kind of social stance by a lot of local administrators to push back against what's happening nationally or some of that rhetoric. And yeah, maybe one day we will see some more peace monuments. I know I'd love to see that here more in Washington, D.C., which is completely just riddled with war monuments and former soldiers on horses throughout the city.
No doubt about that. Well, we are going to move to a break. We're going to be back with more with David Swanson and Bob Schlehuber. David Swanson is coming to us from Russia doing a little citizens diplomacy, so we want to talk to him about that. So definitely make sure that you stay with us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. As always, I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And again, stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing to be joined here by David Swanson, who's an author, activist, journalist, and radio host, and Bob Schley, Huber, a Sputnik News analyst, touching on some current affairs. In the last segment, we talked a little bit about the, white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, my hometown.
You call it that, yeah.
But we're going to move on here as well to other issues. So, David, you are in Russia now. I've followed a little bit of your writings from your trip so far. You've been meeting with a lot of different people. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Russia, why you're there, and maybe some of the contacts you've had a chance to interact with.
Well, I came with a group of 25 or 30 Americans organized by the Center for Citizen Initiatives that's been doing these trips for decades. And we had meetings planned with and have met with former President Gorbachev, with got out moments ago with television news anchor Vladimir Posner, advisors to the Russian government, Russian journalists, Russian business people, Russian doctors and educators. I've been to visit a school. I've been to the RT studio to do a show there. And we're getting numerous varied opinions and different viewpoints from the Russians, very few of which Americans know much about. But it's been extremely interesting, and I'm trying to document every detail at davidswanson.org.
Well, and I'm curious there what the reaction has been among Russians about just all the Russiagate stuff happening in America. I mean, how are they seeing it from their side?
They're amazed. They're flabbergasted. They can't make sense of it. They don't understand how deeply it's been laid down in public opinion in the United States. They imagine that the lack of any evidence is going to be decisive at some point. It's my opinion that people will never be unconvinced by the failure of any evidence to emerge. And they, to a great extent, with some notable exceptions, remain desperately hopeful that Donald Trump is going to be something good for Russia. And I would be delighted to be proved wrong skepticism on that. And certainly I'm doing everything I can to work to make that true. But I think they may be, some people may be misplacing their confidence Donald Trump a little bit.
Well, Bob, I mean, I'm curious your thoughts on any of this, of course, but you also were in the Peace Corps. You lived in Ukraine, so you also have some experience with the people of that region, if I may say. I mean, how important to you is it that people in this country have these sorts of citizen-led attempts to, you know, meet people, learn what's going on, make contacts, and not just simply let, you know, quote-unquote relations be country between countries and between peoples be governed strictly by governmental authorities?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of different things pop in my head. I guess maybe first is thinking about in the 1980s when Billy Joel did the first Western rock concert in the Soviet Union, and all of a sudden Americans and Soviets at that time were able to see how much they had in common, or at least that people were people around the world. So much of the conversation that we have in the United States right now is about Russia, which means the government of Russia, but there's 144 million people that live there, which is what David's encountering, realizing that there's a vast spectrum of political and social ideology. There's a ton of different economic ideology there. And I think often the United States paints just kind of a singular picture. The second thought I have is I kind of want to think about Iraq and the invasion there, of our overemphasis and overreaction towards a small group of people around the world, which must just be, again, the bizarrest thing that Russians must just be laughing. I guess I would ask you, David, I mean, they have to find some of this just hysterical, the hysteria and the day-to-day wall-to-wall coverage of so much of this, the Russia theories that are being put out there, that people in Russia must just think so many people in the United States have gone crazy.
Well, they do to some extent, and I think to a greater extent they blame people of the United States for the actions of the U.S. government than they used to in many cases. But I think, and Russians have an incredible sense of humor and seem to be able to make jokes, and actually funny jokes, about everything. But I think many people, and this is what I've been told by numerous Russians we've spoken with, are just so deeply offended and resentful because they ended the Soviet Union. They tried to make friends. They tried to disarm. Putin asked to join the EU, told to go to hell. Putin asked to join NATO and was told to go to hell. Russia, you know, suffered incredibly, and the United States, you know, poured salt in the wound and laughed and made it worse and declared the United States the sole superpower. And it isn't. And the world sees that solving the real problems facing us of environmental disaster, of terrorism and weapons proliferation is not going to be possible with the United States alone. The United States, of course, its government currently having no interest in accomplishing anything of the sort. These two big powers and the power in China and the powers in nations around the world don't get together and stop this madness, this hostility that is worse in many ways than was the U.S. media hostility during the Cold War. We're not going to be able to solve the problems we have to solve together.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And I'm also curious, just as a follow-up, because I know, and you had referenced this, you were part of a group that was able to meet with Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet leader there. I'm curious, what were his thoughts about the state of U.S.-Russia relations, given that he was in office there in the Soviet Union, really kind of at the low ebb there with the Reagan administration coming in so aggressively anti-Soviet?
Yeah, well, and he says before he and Reagan met was, in his opinion, worse than where we are now. The leaders of the two nations or empires had not met for 6 years at that point. And he puts a lot of weight, I think reasonably so, on the personal interactions between himself and Reagan in terms of what they did accomplish, which was much more than has been accomplished lately. But, you know, what was accomplished in terms of détente and in terms of disarmament was also in large part due to the culture of the time and the activism of the time, and likewise the failure to get real disarmament. But, you know, it's Americans who see McKissick, I think, as someone who took a stand, made a real effort for peace and disarmament, and you didn't have a real partner in Ronald Reagan. And I think a lot of Russians may, you know, disparage Gorbachev as someone who was dumb enough to trust Ronald Reagan and to trust the Americans who have been so untrustworthy. And so I think Gorbachev is in many ways more popular among Americans than among Russians.
Mm, yeah. Well, I certainly can see that. Certainly.
No,
well,
I'm just saying, I mean, it's strange, too, that the United States people, a lot of people have such grievances against Russia, but they turn to their own U.S. government to address those when the U.S. government, like you're saying, has been a big part of the problem. Why not try to build bridges, like you said? I mean, again, there's 144 million people in Russia. There's 321 million people here. But yet the focus point is on the limited number of leaders to then address whatever grievances they have, as opposed to using modern technology to travel, like you're saying, to trade and have commercial exchanges to better relationships. There's could be so much more people to people citizen diplomacy. I mean, I guess going back to the Peace Corps and having been in Eastern Ukraine and talked to people there, I mean, just a lot of it was misperceptions. People just didn't hear one another, hadn't been able to chance to sit and kind of talk through histories. And all of a sudden, when you hear the shared stories, you realize that people have such a strong commonality with one another, much more than they do with oftentimes their elected leaders. And so it's always just kind of a bizarre to me that we focus on such leadership and top-down models of change as opposed to just reaching across the two citizenries.
Well, while we're on the topic of Russia and related things, David, the other thing I know that you're deeply involved in I want to raise is this issue of impeachment of Donald Trump. Now, because of the James Comey firing, the issue has been hot on people's lips. I think it was Senator Blumenthal who raised the issue of Trump going down the road to impeachment. I think, you know, you and I would probably both agree there are probably many reasons that Trump could be impeached, but it seems like the one that everyone wants to focus on is this whole issue of whether or not it's obstruction of justice in the Russia probe to fire James Comey. So as someone who's actively working on the issue of impeachment, I wonder how this whole conversation strikes you.
I think the vast majority of the people who want impeached, which includes, you know, a large percentage of that group is people who wanted him impeached since before day one, want him impeached for whatever they can get him impeached for. And if you can get him on the equivalent of getting Al Capone on his taxes, so be it. And the thing that's in the news, the thing that the Democrats in power and the media in the United States want to put in the news is the Russia story. combination of horrible reasons, and so people are talking about impeachment for that. But if the powers that be and the media that be were to take seriously the financial corruption, the banning of Muslims, the illegal wars, the environmental destruction, and there were talk in Washington of impeachment for those things, in most cases you would have at least as great public support for about those. So I don't think it's really the U.S. public that sat down and considered the options and said, go with the one charge for which we haven't seen any evidence. I think they're just, you know, eager to see Trump gone cases for very legitimate reasons. But I think if we succeed in getting rid of him for the right reasons that create the right climate for who comes next and don't create, you know, further alienated citizens out of all of Trump's supporters.
Bob Schlehuber, your thoughts on this issue?
No, I mean, we talked a little bit earlier today before the show about, I mean, Richard Nixon left office, resigned, and things didn't get better. So, I mean, I guess I still don't buy what's the kind of next thing. And as you're saying, David, so little focus is actually being put on the policy issues that you could aggressively attack Donald Trump on the things that he is doing that are either illegal and that the courts are shutting down and stopping him on, or start to try to at least build a policy shift. But great, so what, that Mike Pence is next and Paul Ryan is next, and if you do new elections, who Hillary Clinton runs again, and all of a sudden she brings policies to the table that people are not going to be excited about already. I mean, I don't know what the alternative that's waiting in the wings that people have their minds on. And I think it's ridiculous to think that, oh, because we are loud on the left and we're in our little bubble, that he could even be impeached. I mean, there's 60 million plus people that voted for the man that are not going to be okay with him just being impeached all of a sudden. So I just don't see any coherent strategy besides obstructionism. And if obstructionism is your goal, and you looked at what the Republicans did to Barack Obama with the whole Benghazi stuff and the birther stuff, then more power to you. But I think so many people are sick and tired of this obstructionism, the showmanshipism. You have the senator, the New York senator, Chuck Schumer, today basically saying, oh, we're not going to appoint an FBI person until you get a special prosecutor. We've already seen the problems with the special prosecutors, which you talked about on the show last week. So if that's not even a solution, he's clearly just doing it for the theatrics and the votes. But more and more Americans are going to be turned off by this. So I just don't see the strategy. I don't see the end goal. And like you said, David, let's focus on the policies. Let's start shifting it back the other direction and actually have a coherent plan of process. But until then, it's just, yeah, it's just noise. I just don't see it going anywhere, no time soon, at least.
The point I agree with you on there is that Trump has a lot of supporters who are not going to want to impeach him anytime soon. As far as obstructing the agenda of the U.S. government, I've been in favor of that completely for decades now. But as far as what happened when Nixon was impeached and there was a movement to Nixon, there's a plausible analysis that says that look at the laundry list of progressive bills that got pushed through during that time. Look at the ending of the war on Vietnam that was made to happen during that time. This was the work of that pressure, and the results that came out in terms of the War Powers Resolution and so forth were at least efforts in the right direction. And had it been carried through better, the results would have been more significant. I mean, this is the problem with this horror of Pence or whoever comes next. If the United States Congress were moved by the U.S. public for popular and legitimate reasons to impeach somebody and declared itself to have the power to impeach and the power to subpoena and the power to oversee the government, then whoever came next would be living under that threat. And that would be a far more significant determination of what happened than who that person was when they stepped into the office.
That's a very interesting point. I think they're very compelling on a lot of different levels. And it makes me wonder, sort of as a follow-up to David, if maybe the sort of subtext here is how much power Congress has surrendered to the president over the last three presidents in particular.
Just about all, you know, and when we talk to Russians and they say, well, of course, Trump should fire anyone for disloyalty. And we, as good Americans, we get offended and think, well, no, people should obey the rule of law and the Constitution and the popular will, not the president. This is mafia talk. You know, we're living in a fantasy. You know, the entire government has been required to be loyal to the president increasingly for decades now, including at least half of the Congress. I mean, parties, with the president being the leader of one or the other at any time, have become the branches of the government, not
the legislative, executive, and judicial. I mean, there is no legislative anymore, Hartman. And in particular on matters of war and peace, the Congress has just chosen to defer to the president. You have six or seven wars going on at any time, and liberal demands that Congress authorize one or another of those wars, as if that would somehow make the war better or help end it or limit it in some way, when, you know, there's no reason to think the president is going to pay any attention when the Congress has allowed, you know, a half dozen wars to continue and decides to authorize one of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let me also, since we're talking about war, slightly shift gears here, David, and I'm curious how, if you are at all hopeful or, I don't know, maybe lacking hope, but either one, as it concerns the Korean Peninsula and things that are happening there. Obviously, there was a missile launch yesterday by the North Koreans for whatever reason. I think probably during the One Belt, One Road conference in China, they were trying to gain some attention. But who knows what it really was. But also a new president in South Korea that is somewhat at odds with the American view on what should happen there in terms of negotiations as well as THAAD. So in either of those developments, are you seeing any sort of change in the status quo here or continued saber rattling moving forward?
Well, I think it's a wonderful result in South Korea. And I've spoken with a South Korean activist who told me that really in the past, warmongering has been able to win elections in South Korea and didn't work this time. And the people really went with an anti-war and we will not be afraid and we will not be fear-mongered vote. And I think that's very, very encouraging, you know, for our species. But I also asked, will this president stand up to the United States? And is there any precedent in the past for South Korea ever having stood up to the United States? And she couldn't think of any. And she didn't know whether it would be the case. So it really remains to be seen whether South Korea will be permitted to kick U.S. weaponry out of South Korea, to stop U.S. military / South Korean exercises in South Korea, to make friends with North Korea, whether that will be allowed, as well, of course, as whether people in the United States will be given any inkling of what's going on. And the fact that the people of South Korea, in great part, see the fight as between the U.S. and North Korea and want it ended.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's certainly a good point. And I saw that the new president there made some points about South Korea developing their own missile defense, which I thought was a pretext for maybe setting up a reason to get the U.S. out of there. But anyway, Bob Schlaehuber, Sputnik News analyst, your thoughts perhaps on somehow this is developing over the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just see this and then I see the news from Syria. The U.S. is accusing Syria of having these crematories for captured soldiers by the Syrian government outside Damascus. Yeah, I mean, it makes me nervous. I mean, I don't know what Donald Trump's plan will be if he is going to have an aggressive, hawkish kind of stance on some of these places, and if we'll ever see boots on the ground or these like military safe zones that he talked about, both him and Clinton talked about during the debates and the lead up. Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of slowly unfolding. I think a lot of people thought he was going to be much more aggressive. Obviously the U.S. military at all times is hyper aggressive, but we haven't seen yet any direct confrontation, and we'll see if the South Korean, the new president there, will be able to quiet things down. But yeah, I'm looking for Syria. I think that's also where we really need to pay attention in the next few days to see if there's more moves there to be done.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I think we'll see. I mean, you know, all these things that come out, you never know what is going to become of them. But nevertheless, it does seem like they're trying to lay some groundwork there by this sort of thing being leaked out here about Syria, whether it's true or whether it's false. But usually these big announcements about terrible things happening are really sort of foreshadowing some attempt for more U.S. intervention. And I think certainly there's a lot more on the table with the U.S. arming of the Syrian Democratic Forces. So a lot there, a lot to be seen, a lot for us to continue to cover. And we will continue to cover it. And I want to thank you, David Swanson, for joining this show. And I hope people go to davidswanson.org. You can follow David's trip over in Russia. Excellent citizen diplomacy happening with him and others there. So definitely an important thing for us to watch. We're going to come back here after this break with more on the worldwide cyber attack ransomware situation that seems to be hitting every country and how you can actually help keep your devices safe and secure. So stick with us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the WannaCry ransomware attack that has attacked people really all around the world. I think 74 countries and counting as of now. And we are very happy to be joined for this show or this segment of the show by Joseph Carson, who's the chief security scientist at Thycotic. Mr. Carson, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. It's a pleasure to be here. And hopefully we can share and educate some people into what to do in situations like this.
Excellent. Well, I wanted to start a little bit there with the issue of what a ransomware attack is. I mean, I think a lot of people have been reading, but I think just to establish a baseline here, what exactly are these ransomware style attacks?
Well, ransomware, they've been actually running for quite a long time, you know, quite a number of years already. And they've various different forms during that time. Most cases of ransomware, what they typically do is a human or a user or somebody will actually click on something. And that piece of malware, malicious malware, will execute. And what it will do is it will encrypt files on your computer. And essentially, you know, sensitive files, documents, spreadsheets. And it will actually prevent you from accessing them. So it'll actually lock you out from actually some, you know, using your entire system until you actually will then go and pay a ransom, which is typically in early years of ransomware, it's been really fueled by the likes of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and so forth. And when you pay that ransom, they will actually then provide you with a key in return. And that key is then used to unlock and decrypt your files, gaining access. So that's typically, it's about restricting and making sensitive information, sensitive data on your systems unavailable to you.
Well, and this one is quite huge, and it's hit a lot of a number of large institutions. I mean, I've seen in the news that a lot of these places, especially hospitals in the past, tend to just pay in this system. I mean, are the people who have been attacked by this ultimately just going to have to pay to get their systems back? Are there other ways they can get out of it, or all that's maybe yet to be seen?
It's going to be depending on what controls were in place by those organizations, institutions, and so forth. And most of our organizations will typically have what's called as a data backup. They will have backups of files and systems and so forth. And ultimately, in these situations, what they'll typically do is restore those backups. And that means is that they can avoid going into having to pay or having to go and communicate with the criminals behind this act. So in most cases, a backup will get you back up and, you know, into an operational running again. However, we all know that not everybody has backups. We know that in many cases, I've even been involved in an instance where the ransomware was actually in the backups themselves. So even restoring them had the ransomware return into the environments. Some cases, it's either you get to face the challenge, do you pay or not pay? You know, our advice, of course, is to not pay because it ultimately fuels and actually, you know, starts actually getting cyber criminals to invest more into creating more severe ransomwares in the future, which we want to avoid.
And so there's sort of over the weekend here, a bit of a kerfluffle in the tech press about who exactly was to blame here. And maybe there's not one culprit, but one of the things that I'm curious your thoughts on that I saw sort of batted back and forth most prominently in the New York Times is this issue of Microsoft and whether or not the fact that they have the tiered support. So if you're using Windows XP, you would have had to pay them to have still been getting the customer service, which is why so many XP users, you know, didn't have the patch, weren't prepared. Africa and Asia caught off guard and hit very carefully. I've seen other people who have sort of said, well, hey, look, this is what happens when you don't update your operating system. Other people have said, yeah, but if you're a huge hospital network, that's more difficult. So, I mean, I wonder sort of where you fall on this issue of Microsoft's culpability or lack of culpability and the widespread nature of this.
I think they have a responsibility to play in this, absolutely. I don't see Microsoft being the sole blame or the sole, you know, attribution going back to Microsoft in this. You know, Microsoft, you know, in many cases, they do try to create software which is secure, is safe for their customers to use. However, ultimately, they do have a responsibility in this to make sure that those who are impacted by such vulnerabilities and get the associated patches. Now, they did take action. I have to say that they on March, I think it was 14th or 17th, that they did actually take action, and they released immediately when the shadow brokers, of course, had released the vulnerabilities from the Vault 7. Once they had released that, Microsoft did take immediate action and did release patches for those. But as you're absolutely right to say, that the process of getting those patches is not easy. It's not simple. Many people, you know, it causes outage and it causes a lot of problems trying to get the applications to work in those updates. So patching is essentially, it's like the horse before the cart. You're always chasing it. You're never getting quite there to the moment where you're patching an environment is safe. And actually, if you look at the map, it's quite interesting because one of the things it indicates, as you know, that many of those who are using later operating systems, the patches are there and they're easier. But those who are using XP did not get the patch in that date. It was only available for Vista and upwards, which is interesting that, of course, now Microsoft are releasing a patch for those older versions. However, if you look at the actual propagation of this, a large number of Russian systems and Chinese systems have been impacted by this because they're using those legacy operating systems. In India, in Africa, so places where they're using legacy operating systems where they may not have the money or the resources in order to keep up to date, to stay past, to use the latest versions, they're the countries and organizations that are at the highest risk of this.
And, you know, one of the interesting things about sort of Microsoft being at the center of this controversy is, and even though this flew a little bit under the radar, I thought it was quite interesting. It was either the end of last year or the beginning of this year, I saw a top Microsoft executive had sort of raised the issue of cybersecurity and said, you know, what we really need is a quote-unquote like a Geneva Convention-style meeting worldwide to talk about cybersecurity, how we secure cyber weapons, how they're used, blah, 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 blah. This is basically just like nuclear weapons war, whatever, how we have some regulation. And I wonder, in the wake of this attack, in your view, if a meeting like that may in fact indeed be necessary.
I think, I have different views in regards to that. I understand the approach, and more it was rather than looking at cyber weapons, more is looking at the actual really focusing at the security of privacy and protection in that regards. So it was more of a Geneva Convention over data protection than it was really about, you know, cyber weapons. Cyber weapons are the use to destruct data, and that's the kind of association. So yes, cyber weapons are a use of basically causing the harm, but ultimately you do need something around the privacy and security element of it. It may hasten that conversation to happen earlier. Though I'm a bit more of a pessimist that ultimately a Geneva Convention style will have an outcome of it.
And I'm curious what you think about this. I mean, it seems like it's falling on so many different levels here, but this was also an issue that was way, and this is where I found out about the Microsoft thing in the context of the WikiLeaks Vault 7 releases, where a lot of the conversation around that was did the CIA basically have enough protections? Was they were maybe being too cavalier, perhaps about using contractors without really sort of thinking through the ramifications? Now, we don't even know if these are technically from the NSA, but alleged, and we don't know how shadow brokers got them. So it's a little difficult to say, you know, whether or not they had the appropriate security. But I mean, is that conversation, at least in the American context, also a more relevant conversation now? What exactly is the government doing in terms of the development of various cyber, you know, capabilities? What is their responsibility in terms of when they find these different exploits and things like that to the companies? I mean, does that need to be elevated to a higher level of discussion politically here in the United States?
Absolutely. It's essential and crucial. That's actually one of my biggest concerns is right now is that we were always in an era that governments were fueling cyber defense. It was all about protecting. It was always about raising the fences and securing systems. Since around, I think the turning point was around 2007, which kind of goes back into the nation state attack that Estonia had experienced. That was one of the turning points. And post that date was when nation states started developing the cyber offensive. And this is really where we're no longer in where cyber has been used as a means of manipulating. It's been used as an actual offensive capabilities, as another element to actually a intent of war. And this is where we have to be really careful is now it's actually getting to the point where cyber can trigger very political, difficulties and challenges between nation states. And this is where it really comes into the government's need to ensure that they're actually dealing with these weapons and these very severe vulnerabilities in a more cautious manner. They should not be letting them get out loose. They should never be on a network where it can actually be exfiltrated. And this is significant. And this is where governments should really taking a leadership in this. I got a little bit concerned more in the recent developments where in regards to the cyber offensive, that it should be in the rights of citizens to do it. That's for me as a no-no. It should always be left, cyber offenses should be left in the hands of professionals in governments, where governments have the ability to actually decide whether we go to war or not. It should not be left in the citizens' hands.
And, one other question I'm sort of curious about in terms of just the way this played out is, where does this fit in sort of the cutting edge of, or if it is the cutting edge of where, I guess, quote-unquote, organized crime is going? I read another interesting story the other day. It was actually a story about a magazine editor preparing a story about how, the cool thing in New York clubs now is no longer selling drugs in the club, but to actually use these credit card readers and to try to steal people's credit card information. And that has become so much more lucrative, and sort of the move of so much activity around how we have so much now in virtual spaces, and the ability to exploit that obviously can make people lots of money. Is this a sign to come of the fact that maybe sort of international criminal syndicates may be focusing more and more on the cybersphere, or have they been doing it for some time and this is just kind of maybe the fruits of that?
This has been, it's been on for many years, and cybercrime has actually got to a point where it's estimated that cybercrime itself is well over $1 trillion. So we've passed that point where traditional, organized crime has already moved. Though we have to say that they are more of a middle layer in this, where they're basically more of the kind of the brokers into basically where they actually translating that into more the financial side of things. And it is more higher level intelligent hackers at the top who's actually creating the tools, and their target audience is the organized crime. They're the ones that's selling it to those in order to actually then use it for the malicious activities. So yes, they are moving to that. But the main focus from an organized crime perspective is the financial side of it. Those at the higher level from the hacking is more about their capabilities showing off. And also, sometimes more of a patriotic scenario, showing a statement.
Interesting. And I guess speaking to that point, there's no way we can know, but it's certainly people are flowing this around. Does this look more like an organized crime attack to you, or could it potentially be a state actor, or is it just there's really no way of knowing at this stage in the game?
There's no way of knowing. I'll kind of can't make the point of this is that some cyber criminal organizations act as both, and that's the problem. Is that when they're basically being given a blind eye to be able to do the cyber crime and also doing political activities at the same time, it's very difficult to do the attribution back to who was really instigating it, who was the motivating kind of whether it being financial driven or political driven behind it. That's the challenge, is that many of these organized crime from a cyber specter is that they are actually doing both. So when you get attribution, it's really hard to actually make the link to a politically motivated direction or directive on that.
And I wonder, should this whole thing give us any pause in terms of how quickly we seem to be moving towards the quote-unquote Internet of Things? Everything now and so many new products, that's the way you sell them, and it's connected to some broad network, and, it can be tailored and matched with all these other things you own, and from thermostats to baby monitors, the whole nine, security systems, everything. Cars, potentially in the self-driving cars. Obviously, many of these technologies could be used in fantastic ways, but have we maybe not looked deep enough into some of the deeper implications of what it means to have so many things "quote unquote" online?
Absolutely. We've been going kind of down this path for many years. When basically ever since the introduction of mobile connectivity, we've started to see. It used to be that your mobile phone was the means of actually facilitating that connectivity to those Internet of Things, the devices that we kind of are using. Sometimes with so-called smart devices, in my mind, I always say it's, maybe connected devices with dumb security. Ultimately, one of the things that we've done is we've made ease of use, simplicity, and we've completely sacrificed security. And many of these devices should really come with warning signs that when you're connected, beware, it can be used for these malicious activities. So they should really come with some type of warning or some type of additional means of notifying the consumer or the business that's actually getting these devices connected, because ultimately they can be used for abusive purposes. And this is ultimately, we really need to come to where there is a line drawn in the sand saying that the basic minimum security that these devices should have is this. And there's also another big, as you mentioned, Internet of Things. My big concern from a more of a security researcher is that when you buy these devices, when you buy that new connected car, or when you buy the home connected TV, that you're actually only buying the actual hardware, the physical device. People don't understand that actually the data that's being collected or the data that's been generated by those devices, you don't own. You have signed that off when you've actually signed up the software agreement or the license agreement. So everything that you're doing, from where you're driving to who's getting into your vehicle to who's sitting in your sitting room and having conversations over dinner and not being recorded by your television, you don't own the data that that's creating. That's actually owned by the manufacturer. And ultimately, this is the data that then is being actually targeted by cyber criminals, because that data can then be used maliciously, either for situations like with WannaCry, with the ransomware situation, or it can be used in order to do more financial gain at a later stage from identity theft.
Mm-hmm. And final question here. For people who are looking at this and figuring like, oh my God, what do I do? How can I be more secure? What are some of the basic things you suggest that everyone just kind of do to try to be as secure as you can be?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the main things is that it's just be aware, is educate yourself on these scenarios, because education is going to help you get a long way into understanding about how these actually tools work. So having a good awareness about the direction that the security is going. The second area is definitely is backup. I can't stress enough times is that having an external drive that you back up your files and then you disconnect it. And then you do that on either a daily or weekly basis, is how frequent or how much content your creation should be, how frequent you are doing those backups. Backups are essential and should be mandatory these days. Another area is, of course, staying up to date, making sure that you apply the latest security patches, making sure you update your software, making sure you reboot your system periodically. These are things that you can do that will definitely help make sure that you are protected against at least known threats. Another thing that I highly recommend, and a lot of people don't actually practice this, is actually when you're using your system or your computer, use a standard user when you're doing your day-to-day operations. A lot of people by default, when you install your home system or your business computer, you're either a local administrator or administrator group. And everything that you do when you're logged in will actually act and work under that level of privileges. So one of the things I highly recommend is when you're doing your day-to-day tasks, actually do it as a standard user, because when you click on something in many pieces of ransomware out there, it will then prompt you to actually enter in higher level credentials or administrator rights. And that's a good indicator that something is actually not working as expected, or something is going to happen that it's looking for more privileges to do so. So actually operating as a standard user is a good practice today, because it then will limit the context of your permissions on that system. So those are the things that, make sure you're educated on what's happening. Two, make sure that you're actually having your systems up to date and patched. Three is basically making sure that you have a backup of your systems, and four, use a standard user.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining the show. That was Joseph Carson. He's the chief security scientist at Thycotic, and that is going to be where we're going to leave it here for today's show. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary, as always, on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.